welcome to Unfrozen. This is Dan Safarik. My guest today is Sarah Velas, who is the founder and operator of the
Vela Cerveza Panorama. And the word Vela Cerveza is invented, so like ancient Latin, there's no wrong way to say the word. But I generally say Vela Cerveza.
Got it. And my understanding is that the Vela Cerveza is an acronym or a portmanteau of your mother's maiden name and your surname?
Yeah, that's correct. So Velas is my last name, and my mother's maiden name is Ace, and in between is Slav, because I have some Slavic heritage.
As do I, as you probably gathered from my surname.
Do you still have relatives in the old country?
Not too many. I think most of them immigrated starting in the 1870s. They did not want to be drafted into the Prussian army. Mm-hmm. So they're a small family on that side anyway. Not too many descendants, but more or less a Chicago family, which broke apart into a little bit of a diaspora, places like Arkansas and Texas, but for the most part, Chicago.
That's great. I love Chicago.
So just as a little bit of background, I did live in LA for a while, from about 2007 to 2011, or no, 13. So it was quite a while. But I never visited the Panorama. I always knew of its existence. And I had a mental note to visit it that just never got actioned. So on a recent visit to LA to visit family and friends in August of this year, or 21, last year, I went to the Panorama for the first time, and I was just blown away, and I wanted to talk to you. So maybe we can talk a little bit about what it is and how you came up with the idea for it, and where it all started.
Well, nowadays, the Vela Cerveza Panorama is located in the historic Union Theater, and we're in the West Adams University Park area near downtown Los Angeles, just north of Exposition Park and USC. And the theater we're in is one of Los Angeles's first purpose-built cinemas, so it dates from 1910. But our general project is to showcase immersive arts and focusing on the panorama, which was a very popular art form in the 19th century. And there are encircling panoramas which surround you in a painting of 360 degrees of landscape. There are moving panoramas which are scrolled along like a moving panorama which is uncranked before an audience, and a scrolling landscape or adventure, an early version of a motion picture. And we have a garden, we have the theater space, which can hold about 70 seats. And we have a few other exhibits, including the Nova Tuscut. And right now, our 360 degrees panorama is Shenjing Panorama, which takes visitors to a view of Shenyang, China, 100 years ago.
Amazing. Yeah. And I mean, just to sort of describe the experience of the panorama from my point of view is that, you know, there are so many, it seems like there are many eras that are coming together in one place. You know, you've got this theater that was established in 1910 and has lived many lives, including as a tradesman's hall, I guess, prior to becoming a church for the Spanish-speaking community in the area. And then now, of course, since 2004, it has hosted the Panorama. And, you know, I think the way that I sort of describe it in a shorthand to people, and I was debating whether to share this with you because I wasn't sure if you'd find it offensive, but I did I did look at some of your prior lectures, which cited Darjeeling Limited, among other films, as a kind of analog for the tracking shot of which the panorama or the moving panorama is a predecessor. So I feel okay saying this now. I tell people that it's a little bit like a 3D Wes Anderson film, because it's so a lot of people don't even know what a panorama is. So maybe we need to back up a little bit and talk about that. It's a very highly curated kind of almost sort of mystical. It's a little bit dusty and fusty, I think purposefully. But what is your fascination with panoramas? I mean, how did you get into doing this type of thing?
Thinking about the word panorama, I believe part of why people don't know what they are historically is because the word panorama has become to mean so many things. It's a photograph feature on your phone. It's a way of describing, you know, a panorama of textiles from Peru, like a wide grouping of traditions or things. So that's one way, is that it's like philosophical resonance became so embedded in language that it disappeared. But the word panorama itself, when it was first used, actually meant an immersive landscape experience. And in the late 18th century, a man named Robert Barker in England patented this as a technology. So the idea that you would go down a darkened hallway and walk up a circular stair and be standing on a platform looking out at a landscape with a scenery that had a hidden light source was something that he patented as a technology. And so what I love about the panorama is that it's not just the painting on the canvas, but it's the infrastructure and the architecture and the other elements, which are sometimes hidden, which come together to create an experience.
Yeah, it's quite, it's somewhere between, you know, the experience of looking at a static painting and a film, but it's also like a 3D diorama of the type that if you went to, you know, older science museums, you would see, where there's a little bit of depth of field, right? But there's also, it seems like you're sort of very conscious of having your depth of field and your sensory perception toyed with a little bit, but in an analog kind of way. You know, there's no digital mimicry going on. And I find that so fascinating, you know, from a spatial and artistic perspective. So I think the story of how you created the pavilion, or rather I keep wanting to say pavilion, got to shake that loose. The panorama was originally a location in Hollywood. Is that right?
So I first founded the Vela Cervese Panorama on Hollywood Boulevard. And this was in the year 2000. I had just returned to Los Angeles from spending time in Europe. I was visiting a number of heritage era panoramas from the 19th century in Switzerland, Austria, and I was based in Paris, which, although there are no panoramas there anymore, or when I was there in the 19th century, there were quite a number of important and famous panorama installations. So I was really fixated on this idea and the way that painting could be a performance, an experience, and a theatrical encounter almost. And I was driving down Hollywood Boulevard. I'd been sent on an errand to find Midwest Lighting Company. And on the way, I looked over and saw this quirky round building with a blue roof and an orange ball on top, and it looked kind of disheveled, and there was a, like, you know, some structures and places you can just feel that they're not currently inhabited. So this site had that feeling, and there was a man in the back patching the chain link fence. So I pulled over immediately and just thought, wow, what a wild building, and talked to him briefly, and turned out that it was, you know, at first I just wanted to take a picture or look at it. And it turned out it was for rent. So I rented it as a short-term experiment to create a 360 panorama. And so that turned into a much longer experiment, which has now been the last 22 years of my life. But this original location, I created a panorama of the Valley of the Smokes. So it showed the Los Angeles Basin 200 years ago. And it's the title's based on there's an idea that some native cultures call this area the Valley of the Smokes, because the marine layer that creates fog and smog is part of what, you know, is just part of our geology and geography here. And so that panorama opened in February of 2001. And as a way to continue the experiment and projects, I formed a nonprofit organization to be eligible for funding and as a way to keep it going.
Amazing. And then it was in that that sort of defunct, it was a former Chinese restaurant, right?
Yes, it was built in 1968. The Sun Sun Rotunda was built for Chu Chu Chinese. And David Chu, you can see his name is on the building permit. He also had a really extravagant Chinese restaurant further east on Hollywood Boulevard. And so this was going to be a more casual, probably takeout focused restaurant. And, you know, at this point, I think it's amazing that somebody, I mean, he was a local business person, had a successful restaurant that was visited by celebrities and things, but very much an individual business person could just decide, hey, I'm going to build this wild, eye-catching building on Hollywood Boulevard. My name's on the building permit. I'm the business owner. I'm the building owner. Can you imagine anybody today opening a Chinese takeout restaurant in a quirky, eye-catching building where they actually own the building and established the restaurants?
No, and I mean,
that seems impossible now.
Totally.
And, you know, 1968 wasn't that long ago, but it's just very long ago as far as how restaurant touring and architecture and even construction works nowadays.
And it was actually that building was in the courtyard of another building, right? Like an older tenement house.
Yes. So that building was built, I think, in 1918. It was a horseshoe-shaped brick building that was apartments, and that building was actually damaged in the Northridge earthquake from the early 1990s. And so from my understanding, it was so damaged, or the owners just decided it wasn't worth saving, so it was torn down after the earthquake because of the foundational problems. So it's funny too, because thinking about how, you know, as like a microcosm of the history of Los Angeles, that this horseshoe-shaped building that was built in the early 1900s, that, you know, people are moving to Los Angeles from the east, still hearing about our wonderful winters of oranges and sunny skies. And then, you know, in the 1960s, this Chinese takeout restaurant is built in the courtyard. And this is right along Hollywood Boulevard next to the on-ramp of the 101 freeway. So when you can imagine this, you know, to catch people's attention, this round building embedded in an apartment courtyard had a flashy sign and a curious look to grab everybody's attention, where you could just pull in, get some Chinese takeout while you were back, you know, to your suburban home in the San Fernando Valley, headed north on the 101 freeway.
And I mean, you know, obviously it's the eye-catching tradition has been picked up by you
in
a quite different location. You know, the neighborhood's very different. The vintage of the building is different, but you've clearly made it your own. What appealed to you about the Union Theater, or were you just sort of desperate to find any place that could possibly, I mean, how many places have a round space where you could just build a panorama? I suppose that's a limited list.
Part of what was so wonderful about relocating to the Union Theater was the contrast of creating a panorama, which was popular before the invention of cinema, and have it being showcased in a movie theater. And the short story of what happened to the panoramic medium is that while it was very popular and even an economically viable form of investment in the 19th century, when cinema comes along, that becomes a much more enticing form of entertainment. And so the panorama industry really dries up at that point for the most part. And so whether directly or indirectly, being able to look at the use of a panorama for something within the context of a cinematic building was very exciting.
Yeah, I mean, the overlap is kind of amazing. And it was actually, was it the first sound theater in LA or the first, one of the first movie theaters, wasn't it?
It was definitely one of the first purpose built. So when you look at the building permit for the theater in 1910, it says purpose of structure, motion picture hall. And that's very early. I mean, there were surely places where films were screened in Los Angeles, but many of them were theater, you know, live theater or vaudeville theaters that then transitioned to be able to show film.
Right. So this was a definite purpose-built room. And what's interesting, of course, is that the panorama is located in what must have been a rotunda in the building, right? Because it is on the second floor. It's exactly as you describe, which is how they're supposed to be executed, coming up through the middle so that you're not interrupting the scenery. But that must have been an architectural feature of the building originally.
Actually, what was also useful about relocating to this structure is that, as you mentioned, it was used by a tile layers union for almost 40 years. So they acquired the building in 1951, the tile layers Local 18, and they actually carved up the structure into a number of rooms to accommodate office spaces. So they left a big portion of the theater for their meetings, halls, and, you know, maybe demonstrations, but the rest of the theater had been adapted to suit their needs. So when we were looking for a place to create a panorama, we found the largest of the office spaces that they had created, we were able to adapt into a circular space. And so again, if, you know, had this had been a theater that was intact from screen to lobby, I would have felt uncomfortable, and it also would have taken more resources to rip out a big chunk of it to create a panoramic room. But the tile layers had already adapted this function, because we know from looking at historic documentation from trade journals that the Union Theater at one point would have had 380 seats. Today, there are about 75 seats, so it had already lost quite a number of functionable seats from when the tile layers had adapted the structure.
Right, but then it effectively becomes a real mixed-use sort of multi-purpose facility, because you have the front office space, which has a gift shop, and then moving back, you've got, on the ground floor, it's kind of a passageway, but then you've got the panorama itself access, and that's on the second floor. And then you've got the raked seating of the theater, and then in the back, you have the garden. So what is the garden original, or did you make modifications to it?
The garden was, when we began in 2004, it was just an open lot. So we adapted that open lot to have a garden. And
lovely.
A number of the plants originally there, we had transplanted from the location on Hollywood Boulevard.
So the programming of the building, I mean, clearly, you know, this is an operation that takes some money to run. You know, you've got, I'm presuming you have some grants from educational foundations, but and there's a modest, you know, admission charge or suggested donation. But do you cater it out routinely for events, and do you have any sort of input or control into what types of events those are? I mean, it feels like a very carefully curated experience from front to back, interior and exterior. So I'm just curious how you manage that and maintain a viable financial operation.
Yes, as with any nonprofit, or actually most any cultural endeavor, that finances are very tricky and actually a huge part of my efforts and everybody's efforts who's involved is trying to keep the boat afloat, so to speak. And we have put quite a bit of effort into soliciting for private rentals for, you know, whether it's a wedding or a bar mitzvah or a baby naming blessing or a surprise dinner party. Those kinds of things have been nice to host and help keep us keep our rent paid and our utilities on. And then also for when it's appropriate for the project, we've served as a filming location for some, you know, Hollywood things, which is also nice in a way, because not only does it, of course, help us financially, but I also enjoy the connection with serving as a backdrop for cinema or even commercials, given that Los Angeles itself has served that function in so many ways since the beginning of cinema, really.
Right. And you mentioned, you know, in some of your other materials about the project, you know, you spent a lot of time looking at Tom Anderson's film, Los Angeles Plays Itself, and you have some philosophical overlay on top of this. You know, it's definitely... I would say it's housed in a philosophy. So maybe we can talk a little bit about the idea of spectral immersion and its relationship to the concept of hauntology, unrestored restoration, and magical urbanism.
In 2008, I was sitting at the front desk welcoming visitors, and a woman came by and, you know, really had her regular visit and started talking to me at the window and said, "Oh, if you ever need a volunteer, let me know. I'd love to help out more." And so that was Ruby Carlson. And since she became involved over the years, we just developed a really wonderful collaborative relationship. So while she started out helping with events and doing photography, she became so embedded in the project that for the past 10 years, we've worked very closely to develop programs and keep the project running. And so when titles are needed to be given, we list ourselves as co-curators of the Velas of Ace Panorama. So recently we were putting together a presentation about some of our projects for a conference by the International Panorama Council. And this is when we developed the concept of spectral immersion together. One kernel of this idea is that, well, something that you alluded to in the beginning of our conversation was that there were layers of time presented throughout the site. And so whereas a place like Colonial Williamsburg is picking like a very specific era to reenact and present to the public, which I think is really wonderful and interesting, we're doing something different than that. And so whereas we are pulling from 19th century traditions of display and typography, we're also picking and choosing elements from other eras that may never have actually overlapped to create almost like a third space. So you have the present and the things that we do and encounter, and then you have, you know, the past or something like, you know, trying to, like, let's imagine like it's 1923 or something like that. And then you could have an overlay of those two things, which are creating an impossible era in time where things are bouncing around and intersecting in different ways.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely feels like a lot of multiple eras are happening at once. Multiple philosophies might be colliding. There's something very, it's evocative, but not necessarily, it's certainly not very deliberate seeming. It's certainly not very focused in the sense of trying to get you to think a certain way. It seems more like you say, accumulation of layers. A lot of people got referenced, you know, in some of the writing about this, or some of the lecturing you've done about this, everyone from Derrida to Luis Barragán, the architect from Mexico, and Tom Anderson, as mentioned, and Mark Fisher, who is kind of a, for lack of a better word, a socialist commentator. How do all these things find their way into the physical environment that people encounter at the panorama?
Well, one thing, let's see, this isn't going to exactly answer your question, but I think it's something relevant. Is somebody was asking me recently about the origins of this project and my background, and one thread in this is that when I was in college, and so from when I was very young, I loved drawing and painting and making things with my hands, and went to art school at Washington University in St. Louis, and ended up joining the painting department, partly because that's where I felt I resonated with the faculty of that department and the students. I was equally interested in photography and printmaking. But I sort of started to have this creeping realization that what you did if you were going to become a professional artist, which, in many ways would be like growing up and saying, I'm going to, play for the NBA or something like that, just as far as like what's financially viable here, like who can actually make a decent living as a practicing visual artist. The thing that you're striving for is a situation where you on the one hand, you're working alone in a studio, creating things in a void that then are unveiled in a white cube amongst a crowd of people holding plastic cups of wine, where they're kind of wandering around pretending like they don't recognize each other, even though they know each other pretty well, and impressing each other with, one-liners of knowledge about esoteric things that and references they don't really know. So, I mean, that's sort of like a cruel way of stating it. And I don't want to knock, I don't have any problem with people who want to sell artwork in a gallery. I think it works for some people. But from my perspective, it was like, wow, that's just not that fun. And, not only is this like a long shot, like, becoming an astronaut or something, it just didn't even feel like something I wanted to strive for. And so as far as for the Velas Lavese panorama, my hope would be that it has an entry point for somebody who doesn't necessarily have a rigorous philosophical background in critical art theory or something like this, but that if you wanted it, potentially like a multi-paragraph essay could resonate with some of the things that we're doing, but it wasn't a requirement for access. Whereas I think some projects that you can encounter in, contemporary art spaces, and I'm sort of using air quotes here, in order to have access to what's going on in the project or sort of like hook people in, they would need to have read this multi-paragraph essay to sort of even understand or get a insight into the ideas being played with and the things being happening. So I want to create something that can grab people on an instinctual level and sort of be like, wow, what is that? Or I'm really kind of feeling something here. And then have the opportunity to analyze it further later if that's something that they're interested in. And so I actually think my working method and the working method of that Ruby Carlson and I have, and some of our other key collaborators, is that we work on some stuff, we create it until it feels right, and then it's not until later that we have a further revelation of like, right, this is what we were doing, or these insightful writings by different cultural theorists really resonate with the goals that we had, rather than the other way around. And it's something that I think when you spend time writing, reading novels or experiencing other people's works of art, those influences and things seep in such a way that then when you're compelled to create something, it's only later that you realize so significantly what had influenced you in making it. But in the moment, you're kind of just channeling something and doing it until it feels right.
Yeah, and I would say for the uninitiated, anyone who has not, been to the Panorama, it is absolutely not necessary to have knowledge of any of the cultural theorists or thinkers to get a completely amazing experience out of visiting. It is very, you have a very instinctual reaction to it. I mean, you have a vague sense that there is an intellectual underscore that something is going on, but it is absolutely not key to decode that in order to have a good and enriching experience there. So I'm kind of relieved to hear that, because you're right. There are a lot of experiences out there in the artistic world that can be very intimidating and kind of have a very high point of entry, and this doesn't feel that way at all. But it's very intriguing anyway. It draws you in. I'm wondering if you, I am sure you are familiar with the Museum of Jurassic Technology. That was the first thing that it made me think of when I walked in there.
Yeah, the Museum of Jurassic Technology is a wonderful, amazing place. And they're truly a kindred spirit of ours. And there's quite a bit of cross-pollination between our institutions and some of the collaborators involved in those two places. But I also really like thinking about the Museum of Jurassic Technology in the context of Los Angeles, because it's truly one of these things that, while in some ways it's not as place-based as the Vela Silvese Panorama is, whereas I think, because we're, having, on some levels, a more direct conversation with the city of Los Angeles and its history. I think the Museum of Jurassic Technology is still one of these places that maybe could only happen here in LA, at least from when it began, because of conditions of real estate and resources and other factors like that. But I also think about places like, Hearst Castle and even the Clark Library, where there's these spaces that are their own dream worlds built out west here that somehow the conditions here allow for these fantastical things to happen.
Yeah, agreed. And I think for the uninitiated, the Museum of Jurassic Technology is a storefront in Culver City that was at some point converted into something like a cabinet of curiosities from the late 19th century in terms of its curatorial stance. There's a bit of a tongue-in-cheek sort of unreliable narrator aspect to it, with jewel boxes containing dubious artifacts that have, very old looking display cases and descriptions around them. But you get this sort of sense that there's some kind of a little bit of a sense of humor running through it that you don't quite fully understand. And to some folks, I suppose they could have the same experience at the Panorama, but you're right, it is absolutely more place-based. And I did want to ask about some of the other things that are shown within the facility that are not the Panorama itself, but things like the pennants that are posted in the theater space, you know, advertising all these businesses and asking people to go to a website or call a phone number, but being done in a format that looks very handmade, that looks very, you know, not mass produced, and like small businesses kind of advertising their wares. What's the story there? What are those about?
In our theater, there's a collection of banners, as you say, and most of them are actually remnants from a project from 2015 called the Polar Film Club. We had a series, Mush to the Movies. It was a 6-part film screening. And so, although this was a partnership between Vela Savese Panorama and Los Angeles Film Forum, both, you know, being small nonprofits, we wanted to give our members free tickets and then offer discounted tickets to anybody else who wanted to come to the series. So in order to help sponsor the viewing rights for all the films, we solicited for businesses to sponsor films. So it could be a business, it could be an individual. And in one case, we had somebody sponsor a banner just to honor their goddaughter. So so it was, it's good old fashioned advertising. You know, theater curtains used to have painted banners with, you know, so-and-so's wheel repair or whatever, like these kind of things as sponsors of a play, or I think even in cinema that was done early on. And so that's what I did for these sponsorships. We had businesses like Revolucionario Tacos, which now doesn't exist, but it's a North African style fusion of tacos and tagines and that sort of thing. They sponsored a banner for a talk by Charles Hood, who went to Antarctica as a writer, poet, and as part of their artistic fellowship program there. But that grouping of banners has been since 2015, so they've kind of gotten their money's worth out of that, I suppose.
So these are, in some ways, these are small businesses, just very unassuming, you know, wanting to advertise in this space. And in other ways, they're some of the others sound like they're sort of deeply entwined in the more, shall we say, philosophical, you know, art curatorial continuum in which you operate. That's fascinating.
That's a great way to put it. Some of the other banners in the theater are remnants from other projects. Initially in September 2020, we had the Union Square Florist Shop, and this was a storefront tableau performative exhibit that people could come and view from the sidewalk. And this was the first time we'd ever designed an event experience where no one would enter the building. And so there was a number of painted banners I created for that. And so we still have one of them on the wall with the phone number that you could call during the event. And that phone number is still active. So maybe try calling the Union Square Florist Shop today.
Lovely. Well, I mean, they're really getting their money's worth then. I mean, and thinking about, you know, trying to really, you know, mediate experiences through a physical space, I'm curious what you think about the recent trends toward a couple of things. One of them, of course, is the much talked about metaverse, where people are going to be absorbed in their computers, in 3D rendered environments, interacting with other people. And the other is this sort of temporary pavilion derivation that has appeared in large-scale commercial storefronts like old department stores, where, you know, traveling shows about someone like Van Gogh or Banksy are appearing and asking you to, in a somewhat commercialized way, experience art that you've received in some other format. And, you know, Banksy's case, it would be street art. Van Gogh obviously would be a gallery, traditional artist, painter. What do you think of that type of thing? Do you feel like they're fellow travelers, or is it just a total abomination?
I think it varies, but first off, with the metaverse, I mean, that sort of thing, I personally feel wary about, uncomfortable. I'm not personally that interested in plugging into the matrix, as it were.
Same.
But I actually think when I think the interest in virtual reality ends up pointing people towards things like the panorama, because, you know, there's one way to look at the medium as it's the ancestor of a type of virtual reality. But I also think that when people, as the, you know, even just the processing power of computers made virtual reality more possible from a, you know, the times that I've tried it out, it used to kind of just give me a headache because of the jerking of the refresh rate and all this. And it was probably a couple years ago, the first time I played somebody's video game terminal with a VR headset and was like, oh, wow, I can do this and not feel a headache, or, you know, like you can really just feel it, like the technology disappears a little bit. I don't think that will ever completely erase our desire to do things physically in person. So it becomes another option or another way or another medium. But just like, you know, now that we've all spent a lot more time on video calls or Zoom or whatever, it's been great that I could occasionally see my sisters through Zoom, but nothing would replace getting to see them both for the first time post-pandemic, you know, when we hadn't been around each other for 2 years. So in some ways, having the rise of these disembodied experiences reaffirms how nice it is to be in an analog situation. So that's something about VR in the metaverse. And then as far as the, I mean, it's a curious thing. And I think also even just the repurposing of empty big box buildings is curious in and of itself, and that these physically manifest digital immersive experiences are popular is interesting. Sometimes it's also a case of marketing, because I wonder if we had the same marketing budget as the Van Gogh experience, if what our public response would be.
Exactly.
But you know, on the one hand, I feel like, well, if it really is carrying people to an exciting place, then that's great for them. You know, it's kind of like, well, if it's taking them there, then that's nice. I haven't attended myself, but from the footage that I've seen, I think I would feel funny about it being so based on Van Gogh's work, because I'd almost wish, oh, well, if you're going to do this, like, why use his paintings? Like, why not create something new with this capability? I mean, I get it why that's a reference point for people. But I also think the word immersive, while it's kind of becoming a catchphrase or shorthand for certain types of experiences in these types of marketings, or even like an immersive museum experience or this and that, it's still just a descriptor, like beautiful or interesting. And it doesn't always mean the same thing to all people. And that the depth that can happen through an installation that's been created, whether purposefully or by accident over decades and decades, is different than something that goes up for a couple weeks in an old Target that can then go away. And so this almost like the patina and detritus of effort and time is very hard to recreate. And
I think that you said it perfectly. You know, the patina and detritus of past time is really what is most striking about being in the panorama space and the few spaces that are like it. I mean, like, you can smell the dust motes. You can feel the floorboards creaking. You get a real sense of history, even though you know that this is a fairly recent creation that is actually constantly being updated and is being, you know, curated. It's still, you still feel like you've discovered something, you know, and I think that that's a pretty difficult thing to replicate by digital means.
One of my most favorite places in the world is Heinhold's First and Last Chance Saloon, which is a bar in Oakland in Jack London Square. And it's, you know, somewhat famous for being a place that Jack London used to write at. And it was at a port of call in when sailors would ship off in the early 1900s. But it, when you go inside there now, they're like the bar from the earthquake in 1906 is at this crazy angle. The floorboards are all over the place. It's like, it's almost like one of those vortex houses from a roadside attraction. But the people would, sailors would leave money on the wall at, as a, like a good luck gesture with the hopes that when they would come back, they could use it. And so there's this, you know, old hats all over the place. The bathroom's in this crazy wooden closet, and part of it just has so many stories embedded in it with this, like the debris of the oil lamps and this kinds of things. And I don't know that they would ever intentionally promote themselves as an immersive art experience, but that's the kind of feeling I have when I go there.
That's a great recommendation. I now know what I'll be doing next time I'm in the Bay Area. Well, we have just a few minutes left, and I wanted to hit on something that you had mentioned in our discussions running up to this talk, which was that you were interested in doing things to help better activate street life. And, you know, I have some sense of how, you know, some of the exhibitions that have been staged at the Panorama, or rather in the lobby of the theater, might accomplish that. But I would be curious where you thought that could go, you know, especially as people are, you know, reconsidering the street as a public space in ways that they probably hadn't thought about it very much, you know, prior to the pandemic when everybody was locked down. You know, they started to really value those shared spaces. And, you know, in a city like LA that's so based on the automobile, it can be difficult to claim public space and have that be, you know, feel really like a safe, owned place that you can share in. So I'm curious, you know, what you think some, you know, improvements that can be done that aren't, you know, don't have a 30, 40 year lead time in a gigantic, you know, public planning budget.
Yeah, I mean, it's such an interesting point, because I think actually when you start to look into some of these things, it does come down to zoning and allowable activities. I mean, one thing that's been great about changes that has happened during the pandemic was even things like sidewalk dining were pretty inhibited from a code perspective in Los Angeles. And so this need to be outdoors for safety reasons, these emergency allowable things were put into place, which have actually added quite a lot to just, you know, even walking around or driving around and seeing these funny cement pylons that turned a parking space into a dining area is pretty neat and pretty special. And so I'd love to see changes like that made much faster that would allow somebody to have, you know, more pushcart vendors of food or souvenirs or anything really. If those kinds of changes could be made in building code and you know, what's allowed, we were able to make those changes quickly during the pandemic. Why not have that approach now?
Got it. Yeah. I mean, you know, it really seems like we should be capitalizing on that.
And even things like signage, I think, well, now maybe some of the things have been relaxed, but there was a period of time in Glendale where some kind of ordinance was passed that made signs over a certain size illegal. And so all of these historic and beautiful neon signs were forced to be taken down because this ordinance was passed. And, you know, what could we possibly do to incentivize interesting, beautiful signage?
Right. And I mean, fortunately, I think some of those items were preserved in what is now the Museum of Neon, but I'm sure not all of them were.
Yeah, and then, you know, there's a double thing where, of course, let's try to preserve and protect what still exists, but how could we incentivize the creation of new interesting things? When you look at new apartment buildings or even commercial buildings, or they tend to have a very standardized, boxy look. And part of that is the effort to maximize square footage because that's what takes in the most money.
Yes, exactly.
But could there be a way to incentivize things that look interesting? That'd be very hard to codify legally, but I wish somehow there was a way to do it.
Well, I think if you keep carrying on doing what you're doing and it gets better publicity and there are more kindred spirits around who could perhaps leverage some of these platforms that we've been talking about with some degree of wariness, combine that with a resurgence of urban life and in interested and curated experiences, and all those things align in the same way that your diagram of hauntology, unrestored restoration, magical urbanism, and spectral immersion, if that all comes together, we will be in utopia. Well, I really want to thank you for your time. I really enjoyed hearing about the genesis of the panorama, and I would encourage anyone who is in LA to go visit it. It's a completely unique experience.
Thank you so much for having me. It was wonderful to speak with you.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
Thank you.